Welcome, Martin, to Think Visual with Shapeshifters. Thank you so much for coming along and being part of our new podcast series. Today we're really interested in finding out a little bit about what makes you tick and all the kind of interesting work that you get up to.
Thanks for having me. Looking forward to the conversation.
Fantastic. Interested, Martin, in particular about your background, because it's interesting. You said your life started off in Austria, and I'd like to find out a little bit about how you came from where you were all the way to Sydney and doing what you do today.
Well, I think I was always really interested in illustration and design, and I was at school, like from the early years, I was really good at, naturally really good at visual arts, I think is what we were calling it at the time. And I remember starting sketching early or doing illustrations early, and actually my mother kept some of the illustrations I did when I was young, and I was looking at them the other day, and I, like for my brother's birthday, I made like a little illustrated book for him about, I think it was about a bird family that was looking for a tree to build a nest. So I started sketching quite early, and then also started trying to think about the impact through the sketches as well. So it was, I think in year three or year four, I remember when it was at a time when refillable fountain pens were being replaced with cheaper biro pens, essentially, like one-way use biro pens that you don't refill, you just put them, they're cheap, and you use them and then you throw them out. And I was mindful about the impact on the environment already at the time. And so I remember creating little sketches of sort of a fountain pen, comic style, a fountain pen fighting one of the cheap throwaway pens. And then distributing it somehow in the glass. I can't remember exactly the details, but my teacher helped me do that. And we were, like, I grew up in the country, so it was a very small cohort. But trying to advocate, I guess, for the use of reusable fountain pens and reduce the impact on the environment. And then later, so because I grew up on an organic dairy farm, so my parents are running a dairy business. And it was at a time when there weren't many organic, there wasn't much organic produce. You couldn't just walk into a supermarket and buy organic products there. So it's very grassroots. And one of the things we were selling was yogurt, so organic yogurt. And I was creating some of the labels, helping create some of the labels some of the designs for the labels of the products that we were selling. And we were using it for years, which was really cool. And then I guess from there, when I graduated from high school and started looking at university, I was really keen to study visual arts. So I was looking at this particular in Vienna, there's a university on applied visual arts. So I was looking at that. But I was pretty good at sketching. I wasn't brilliant, and I knew I didn't have a great portfolio because I went to sort of a technical high school where I learned programming at the time, and programming was quite new and about computers and electric circuits, but it probably meant I didn't have the right portfolio, and I was aware that I might not actually get into that university. So that's where I think it was a bit of a crossroad for me, where I went to visual arts university, went to the business university, and ended up in a technical university studying what was called informatics. Partly because I could see how it would allow me to bring all my different interests together in a way. And so then through that degree, I then found what at the time was called usability engineering and interface design, and then moving from there to UX and interaction design, where I was sketching plays a big role, and then coming to Sydney, being able to teach in a design school and work with students to help them use sketching for ideation and also to create things like wireframes and prototypes.
That's really cool, Martin. I didn't know that you had this such an eclectic kind of experience of using kind of visual arts and kind of sketching. It's just interesting to hear about that, and it kind of makes sense in some ways, because I I've seen you sketch before. You do it very comfortably. It's like a second language to you. Well, at least when we've observed.
I think it's more around sketching diagrams for me, I have to say.
Yeah.
And I make a bit of a difference there where if you ask me to, I think I attended one of your meetups and they asked us to sketch an animal, and I was trying to sketch a chameleon and it was terrible. I could somehow visualize it in my head, but I couldn't bring it onto paper, and I tried to sketch it out, but the person next to me could not guess what it was. I mean, they were thinking a lizard, so it was pretty close. And then I looked up some images on Google, and like, I know you find all these images that are kind of like child drawings and amazing. Like, I know, and it's this whole idea of when we're children, we don't overthink too much. And so it's actually often kids are really amazing in drawing animals because they don't have that barrier, that's a filter that's trying to sort of sense check what you're doing and drawing. Yeah. And so I think because I have nurtured illustrating, I'm not as good at that as I used to be. And now I see myself more as a strategic designer. And for that, it's important that I know that I'm comfortable drawing diagrams and, like, I don't know, standing up on a whiteboard and sketching out things. But it's synthesizing a conversation or capturing a conversation. But it's not, and I always say to my students, you don't have to be good at sketching in order to be able to sketch. And I think the amazing work that you and Diana do, Shapeshifters, that's an art form for me, but that's something that I haven't nurtured. So I'm not as good at doing those kinds of illustrations. But again, you don't have to be an amazing artist in order to be able to sketch.
I could not agree more, Martin. You can use sketches for kind of anything. I think as long as you're able to communicate, and there is my next question is about how important is sketching to you in terms of communication? What does it do for your communication?
Well, I guess I use it in different settings. So as an academic and when we do academic research and also write about our research, we then use sketching and diagrams to communicate the research. So even when we write academic papers with my colleagues and PhD researchers, we always try to have some kinds of kind of diagrams in there that visually summarize the findings that we have. Then we also use, of course, sketching in our work as part of an iterative process. And there's also a communication element there in that, like, I might have an idea for a prototype in my head, but if I put it on paper, then I have to start thinking about what it actually looks like, the details. Like the chameleon, when I'm trying to draw a chameleon, and I have to really think about what does the tail look like, and the ears are really hard. And then there's the tongue that sort of curls up. So you start thinking more about the details, but also then I can start having a conversation with you, right? And we can look at it together and go like, I can talk about how this works, and then maybe you can add something to it, or you might find some gaps in things that are missed in that sketch. And then in sort of my more day-to-day work around like being in meetings, I sometimes use sketching to, like I said earlier, to capture a conversation maybe on a whiteboard, or to synthesize some of the things that are being discussed, or to guide a conversation even sometimes. Apart from, of course, taking notes myself, which sometimes includes sketches, but that's more for myself to come back to it, less for communication purposes.
Yeah, wow. So, I mean, it's still, you find it for yourself as something to revisit. How does it help you revisit an idea?
I mean, first of all, I think it helps me to think about something differently and synthesize. Sometimes when I hear something and I try to make sense of it, I try to sort of sketch it out in a diagram. And maybe it can be something simple like a Venn diagram or a pyramid, triangle. And I try to think about the different dimensions of something that we've just discussed, and then how that intersects, or whether there's a new way of looking at it, maybe, that emerges from sketching it out. And then sort of like revisiting it. I mean, I have to say, I take a lot of notes I still have a physical notebook. I don't too often go back to them. So it's really, for me, probably more the act of writing down things and sketching down things than coming back to it. That's more rare.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, there is something that we kind of came back to when we were working together. I don't know if you remember, I think you were trying to communicate this idea about how one system relates to another. And you had drawn this diagram in your diary. This is while we were working on your, mm-hmm. your book, Designing Tomorrow. I don't know what your thoughts at the time were, but while Diana and I were observing your process, it was definitely giving us a catalyst, a whole starter of ideas mm-hmm. for how we might incorporate that as a form of wayfinding or navigation within the book. Mm-hmm. Do you recall this thing that you're working on? And yeah. What was your thinking behind it as you were doing it?
So you are referencing what we call the octopus diagram?
Yeah.
Okay. So I think that's a good example of where I was trying to use visual thinking, sketching, to synthesize the ideas from the book. So in the book, we have three strategic design pillars, and each of those pillars has three tactics. So I was trying to think of a why, and it was already before that, we had already a few conversations with my co-author Steve about this idea of visualizing that somehow. And so I was able to also build on those previous conversations that we had, and then trying to capture that in a visual form. And there were, I guess, I can't remember exactly, but I went through a few different iterations of what this could look like and how it might connect, and also how it could become something almost like a compass that helps readers to navigate the book, but also a sort of like a summary of the key things from the book in one diagram. And I think we ended up with a few different versions.
Yes.
Like one that was a bit more complex but complete, and then another one that was more simplified but became more like a navigation tool for the reader.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. It was, it definitely was a navigational tool, I think, in the end. But just the way you were working on it, here and there, and even while you were talking to us, and maybe you weren't even trying to necessarily show us, but it looked like you were trying to work out the way that the diagram itself would function. Mm-hmm.
Also interesting. It's helped me because I started trying to draw the connections between the different tactics.
Yeah.
So it helped us also to think through how the tactics in the book are connected, which is actually a layer that I hadn't accessed before that. So in a way, the sketching helped me access another layer in terms of how I was looking at the book and the narrative and the tactic in the book, and how we then were thinking about how these tactics connected and did we miss any connections.
Yeah. Speaking of narratives, what do you think is the role of visual storytelling in particular in Designing Tomorrow? And how have you seen it being used, or what have you heard? Do you feel like it has changed the reader's experience mm-hmm. in terms of absorbing that mm-hmm. information?
Well, I do think, and I also hear that from people, that when you pick up a book and you sort of flip through the pages and you see illustrations and diagrams, that it makes it much more accessible than a book where you just have words. And sometimes realized, I don't know if that's a trend, that some publishers start using smaller and smaller font to fit maybe more words into this.
Okay.
It's more economic printing, more environmental too in some ways, but I find that quite hard, sometimes quite overwhelming to look at those pages full of small text. So it's definitely making it more accessible, breaking up the text. We made an interesting choice in the book that we are not actually referencing the figures. Partly we did that so that in the future there could be an audio version that doesn't need to refer to the figures, but also not to break the narrative. And it's almost, again, like two different layers that the reader can access. They can either read the text, or they can sort of browse the figures, and the figures become a summary of the text. In terms of how we used illustrations, there were I would say three different ways how we used illustrations to communicate the content or support the content in the book. So the first one were diagrams, where we essentially, sometimes they were like a chart, but trying to present it not just as a functional chart, but more like a story in itself that the chart tells, or thinking about the story that the chart tells. So visualizing some data or methods, tools that involve some kind of like diagram. And then we had illustrations that were sort of supporting the narrative. So one of the illustrations is on the t-shirt I'm wearing today. So this is the illustration for the notion of life-centered design, which is the idea so that the human is decentered from the design process, and we're considering all of the different entities that are involved in or affected by the design process. So those kinds of illustrations, I think, are really nice in that they're breaking up the text and they're giving visual, they're providing visual anchors for the reader. So we got another one around, one that we worked quite a bit on, I remember, around exponential growth, which is this idea that you put a rice grain on the first square of a chessboard, and then you duplicate the number of rice grains on each subsequent field of the chessboard. And you can see how very quickly it becomes an astronomically high number of rice grains that no longer fit on the chessboard. So it was an interestingly challenging visualization to do, but I think having that there is a really nice anchor point. Maybe also for people reading the text, reading about exponential growth and then wanting to find that spot again, and just browsing the book and going, oh, this is the illustration, this is where the text reference is. And then the third visualization we used was the sort of what we call the chapter illustrations. And they were usually based on a subtitle, so of the chapter. So the first chapter has the subtitle, The Titanic and the Canyon. And those subtitles, we crafted them so they're a bit of a hook for the reader, to a bit of a glimpse of what's to come in the book, but also kind of like piquing interest in the chapter. And so we're sort of revealing then throughout the chapter why we chose that subtitle. And the illustration supports that narrative. So the illustration, the chapter illustration that we worked with you guys on, is visual, kind of like a visual hint at what's to come in the chapter. And the idea was to make the reader a bit curious about the chapter and what the story that's going to unfold in that chapter.
Yeah. That's really
the one other thing that I heard, because you asked about what I've heard from people, is the consistent feedback I'm getting is people picking up the book and going like, oh, this is an amazing book, looks beautiful, beautiful book. So they just judge it by the cover and the illustrations. And I was going, oh, hopefully you will say the same about the narrative of the book when you start reading it. But it's always nice to have that immediate response, that people connect with it and think it's a beautiful book.
I was just thinking that in particular, I subscribe to this idea that visuals help you create a mental anchor for knowledge. So you know, that rice grain image, as you were talking about, it's a great place, or it's a great way to help the reader connect where something is in, you know, physically in the book. And we've seen this happen in diagrams or in posters, in many different contexts where people are absorbing information. But then the moment they're trying to recall it, the image helps you remember. It's like a little doorway or a pathway to knowledge, and saying, okay, this is what that was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like the I often ask this kind of thing, like, or pose this thing: can you think of your favorite book? Right, and if you thought of your favorite book, mm-hmm. And I asked you, what flip to the halfway point, what are the words on the pages there? Do you remember mm-hmm. the words on your favorite
mm-hmm.
book?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you may have read this book 10 times, 20 times, mm-hmm. but chances are you'll flip to the middle of the book and you won't know what the words are. Flip to the last page of the book, you won't know what the words are. But if you look at the cover, you'll know what's on the cover, generally
yes.
speaking, even
yes.
if it's a very plain thing.
Yeah.
And it's, I think... It definitely comes down to the fact that we are primed to use visuals to kind of help us navigate. And
yes.
I liked what you were talking about in terms of wayfinding and navigation. I think that makes a lot of sense to us.
Although it's interesting also how that's changing with, I guess, the things becoming more digital. So thinking about, for example, reading books on a Kindle, where you might not even be able to see the cover on your Kindle, or
True.
If you have the setting on, then you see it, but it's black and white, so it doesn't maybe stick in your mind as much. And same with I used to be obsessed with collecting CDs when it was still a thing.
Yes.
And now everyone listening to music on Spotify, like probably, like, you know, we don't have the same connection to the cover artwork.
True.
Whereas back in the day, I could probably tell you about all, I could probably recite all of the cover images for my CDs and also connect the sort of like connect each CD through the visual. So exactly what you're saying, the visual anchor. But we don't have that ability on Spotify in the same way. They're still using covers, but in a different, it's a different basic
it is.
Role. So it's interesting how that's also changing. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's one of the reasons I still like physical books also.
Yeah, I think that's the same. I think the digital stuff, I think, is the natural course that we're kind of going down. It's not like that's going to change, I think. Not anytime soon, anyway. But
it's also interesting. I don't know if any academics will be listening to this podcast, but in when you write papers, and often, like, I know they're quite the dry format dictated by the academic publishers, and like, they all look the same, the title, the authors, the abstract, the introduction, related work, etc. But there's a bit of a trend, recent trend, to include what we call a teaser figure, right under, I think it's below the author names, before the abstract. And so it goes across the page, teaser image, and it's kind of like some of the key images from the study, maybe diagrams or photos of a prototype or something. And that's another nice way, in a way, serves as an anchor, I think a bit similar to what you're saying, for people to remember a paper based on the teaser image, as well as being able to have a quick visual summary when someone looks at a paper, goes like, oh, this is what the paper is about.
Yeah, that actually makes me think of what the role of visuals in academia are. Like, what do you see is the role of visuals in your work as an academic?
Yeah, definitely to visualize our and communicate our findings. And I mean, papers is one way, but I think the something that we need to get better at maybe is how to, we as a research community, is to communicate our research so it's more accessible to a wider audience. And we definitely tried to do that with Designing Tomorrow a little bit as well. And that's again why the visuals played a big role in that. Traditional academic books don't have as many images or illustrations in particular. They might have photographs maybe of prototypes or artifacts. But yeah, I do think we can get better at that. And also, if you're thinking about sharing our research on LinkedIn or social media platforms, for example, that we could use then those key illustrations or figures to communicate the research again to a wider audience. Yeah. There's a bit of a trend, maybe in particular in science, the field of science, on visual abstracts, which is kind of a bit of a similar idea, but it's something that I think we could, as a research community, we could get better at and be paying a bit more attention to. And it's not necessarily at the core of the academic education system.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And as a designer, what do you think, what do you think is the role of visuals as a designer? And if you were thinking about this as a somebody who's thinking about becoming a designer, who's studying to be a designer, what would you say to them about the significance of visuals in their work as a designer?
For me, there's three things. So the first one is, as I also mentioned earlier, to help us think through an idea. So it's what in the academic literature, Donald Chern was talking about this in his work, studying architects and how architects use sketching and design. And this is an idea of what he calls talk back. So as we sketch on the paper starts talking back to us. And so in a way, we're putting an image in our, from our mind onto paper in the physical manifestation, and then that creates a loop, kind of like a communication loop. So that's the first one. The second one is to, we talked about this a bit earlier as well, to support communication. So that could be communicating in a team, whether it's in a design team is an obvious one. And that's relatively easy because as designers, we're all trained in how to do that, how to sketch and use visuals. But also, I guess now being working more in a transdisciplinary environment. I think sketches are also really important communicating across disciplines, for communicating across disciplines, because it might, it's just an additional language that we can use. But then that becomes a bit more tricky to do, right? Because you might be talking to someone from a different discipline who's not as used in understanding symbols. And I think wireframes were a good example, where there was this big trend around wireframes, and wireframes and user interface design have a particular connotation. Like, for example, images, image placeholders being like a rectangle with a cross, with two lines as a cross in within the rectangle. And that there was then, initially that was used quite a lot, and then there was a bit of a pushback, sort of arguing that it's not something that should be shown to a client, for example, because the client might not understand it, but even possibly other teams within the organization might not understand, or you might have to first explain what this means and why you're using these particular symbols in your wireframes. So it becomes communicating via sketches becomes a bit harder when you go outside of your design discipline. And then the third one would be to persuade. And I think that's where it also becomes more important to think about the story we tell through the images. So it's not just a chart with data or a diagram, but it's actually how does this diagram or graphic tell us a story? And that helps us to then persuade someone. That could be, I don't know, it could be our boss, because we have this idea and we want to persuade our boss to invest in that idea. Or it could be to the client, persuading the client to pay for a particular feature or like a particular product that we think that they should develop, or a particular strategy they should develop. Or it could even be, I don't know, it could be to persuade even government around the need for particular policy interventions. You could use those illustrations to help to do that as well. Yeah. So those are the three aspects for me. So it's to help us think, to communicate within teams and with others, and to persuade others.
Just one last question on the persuasion part. How does it help you persuade somebody, and how does an image help you persuade?
Because it makes an abstract idea more accessible, and because it's usually easier for the other person to take it in. Whereas if you would give them, I don't know, a 100-page report outlining our idea with like, you know, a lot of academic backing and articulation of why this is important, and even, I don't know, some modeling maybe in there, but it would be very hard to access. Whereas if we have visuals that support that narrative, then it becomes much easier to understand, and therefore supports the persuasion or persuading people about the need to do something. It's a bit dangerous because it could easily be misused, of course. And I guess we see that with, I don't know, misinformation and fake news. So it becomes, the ethical question becomes quite interesting as well, to then think about that and how and why it's therefore really important that we're not just teaching designers, design students, how to think visually and how to sketch out ideas and use visuals to persuade, but also the ethical dimension of how to use these superpowers that designers have in a purposeful way.
Yeah, that's a really great answer, actually. That's something that I don't think is talked often enough about, is one, the fact that the image can turn something abstract into something that's more accessible. Mm-hmm. But then two, how to use an image with purpose, how to use something with reasoning. So you're actually thinking about, what is this image doing? I think in some ways it makes me think a lot about the way people are using AI to generate images kind of whimsically, and not necessarily thinking about the implications of what that image is actually becoming.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. The critical reflection and kind of interpretation is still really important, or even more important when it comes to using AI.
Yeah.
And it's too easy for people to just type something into a generator and then get an output and just use that without critically reflecting of what it actually means and stands for, and is it the right way to communicate what we want to communicate.
Yeah, I think that's
a good point.
We find that's really the point of differentiation between, say, a human and AI is the fact that we will think about not just the in the style of the image is almost irrelevant. It's more about what is this image saying? What's the intention? What do we want to get out of the people that are looking at this? And we think about this all the time. Whenever we create something, we're trying to think of how the person is receiving this, and the not only the reaction, but how they might be able to interpret this. So it's never created kind of whimsically. It's always with thought, and then the style is kind of just the icing, really.
Yeah. You know? Which is really why generative AI should be more seen as a tool that is used in a process, but it's not generating the end output.
Yeah.
The end output still needs to be generated by the human.
Yeah. That's a great point. Well, Martin, that was a great way to kind of end our conversation. But for people who are looking to find out more about what you do, and in particular, life-centered design that you mentioned earlier, where's the best place to reach you?
So I'm on LinkedIn, so people can find me on LinkedIn, and I post quite regularly there. I'm also on Instagram, posting a little bit less there, and also on Threads, not using that much anymore. So I have a website as well, a portfolio website that I don't update too much. If you Google my name, you can find that. There's some examples of my research projects and other links to my publications. To find out more about, I guess, life-centered design and our book, Designing Tomorrow, we've got a website, which is designingtomorrowbook.com. And we also have all of the amazing illustrations and graphics that Shapeshift has helped us produce available on the website for free for download under Creative Commons license.
Fantastic. Well, we will make sure to include that in the show notes, but thank you so much for being here, Martin.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for having me.